Hey, Gully, welcome back. I can't tell you how happy I am that you're back for this week's episode. I bet everyone listening is happy, too.
Ah, thank you so much. I missed you and all of our listeners. And I haven't had a chance yet to congratulate you on getting the speaking slot of the year at MTP Conference in London. That is awesome. I'm definitely going to be right at the front so I can heckle you properly.
I would expect nothing less, and thank you very much for that. I've spent the last couple weeks completely freaking out and really getting started on the talk. It's going to be a good one, but it's a bit freaky. But what have you been up to?
Well, I went on a free diving course, which was awesome, but actually I wasn't feeling great and it turns out I had COVID. So I've just been recovering from that over the last couple of weeks. But honestly, there's a lot of fun stuff to learn about breathing when you're doing a free diving course. And it was great to step out of my comfort zone in a new way. And you just can't put a price on an experience like that.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I wonder what the price for a course in a niche specialist subject should be. Isn't that the kind of thing you cover in your day job at BBC Maestro?
Yeah, it is exactly. But I'm not sure I'm a pricing expert just yet. So this week, we've got someone who absolutely is. We're chatting with Dan Belkowski, founder and chief pricing officer at Product Tranquility. And we covered absolutely loads of stuff.
And we both got some really good guidance from him during the chat. So let's not waste any more time. Let's get straight into it. The Product Experience is brought to you by Mind the Product. Every week on the podcast, we talk to the best product people from around the globe.
Visit mindtheproduct.com to catch up on past episodes and discover loads of free resources to help you with your product practice. You can also find more information about Mind the Product's conferences and their great training opportunities happening around the world and online.
Create a free account on the website for a fully personalized experience and to get access to the full library of awesome content and the weekly curated newsletter. Mind the Product also offers free Product Tank meetups in more than 200 cities. There's probably one near you. Dan, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. How are you doing this week?
I am doing fantastic, Randy. It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. So, for anyone who doesn't already know you, can you just give us a quick introduction? What are you doing these days, and how did you get into the world of, well, not product, but pricing?
Yeah, well, like I said, it's great to be here. My name is Dan Belkowski. I run a consulting firm based in beautiful, sunny Austin, Texas, where I help high-volume B2B SaaS CEOs define pricing and packaging for new products. I've spent my entire 20-year career in software, started more on what you might call the value creation side than the value capture side that I'm on today versus an engineer and then engineering management. Ultimately, I became a lot more fascinated by how products created customer value and turned into dollars and cents for the business. Also, just temperamentally, the code never cared how mad I got at it. It still wouldn't run. So I realized that maybe the software engineer route wasn't the long-term best path for me. Ultimately, you know, those interests led me to pursue an MBA. I didn't realize at the time. I was quite lucky with my just choice of graduate program. It was widely recognized excellence in marketing. I didn't find out till very recently that many business programs have courses in pricing. So I received a lot of my theoretical grounding in pricing there. And then during that internship, during grad school, worked for a very successful Silicon Valley startup where one of the questions on the CEO's desk was, should they pursue a freemium model? And so kind of right away, I got thrown into the world of pricing. TLDR, we may come back to it later, but I do not recommend freemium in the B2B SaaS world. So that may be a holy war. I am happy to continue fighting down the line, but we'll just leave it at that right now. You know, after business school, ultimately, I took a series of product management, product strategy roles, increasing levels of seniority. Ultimately, was head of product at a startup. And then about 4 years ago, decided to go off on my own and give a hand at consulting. So I've been doing that. And now all I do is, you know, have the privilege of helping, you know, B2B SaaS CEOs and their teams build profitable businesses and fulfill their company's missions.
Fantastic. So before, well, aside from freemium, we'll get to that later. What else do people get wrong about pricing? You know, this is kind of a mystery and a dark art for lots of us. So what is the most common thing you see that people get wrong?
Yeah, it's a dark art. I think only if you keep thinking of it as a dark art. It's got more science to methodology to it than maybe most people look at. But I think the number one thing I see is when it comes to SaaS pricing, most executives think that what you charge determines your success. In fact, who and how you charge determines your success. So I would spend a lot more of my time on what the price tag goes on and little time on what number goes on the price tag.
Okay, so let's start with the basics. Or from the foundation, like how do you know that your pricing is right? Like what are the signals that you are getting it right or getting it wrong?
Well, depending upon, you know, where the company is in their life cycle, right? They may have, there's going to be different symptoms that we may see, right? So I think one of the questions is how early in your pricing or how early in your product or company journey should you really be absolutely focused on pricing? And what I tend to see is that, look, pricing is one of these things that's people always have questions about. It's always not quite perfect. But early on in a company's trajectory, say if you have a startup, right, it's three founders in a room, they're probably spending all of 4 hours on a Saturday kind of coming up with their original pricing and packaging and then maybe never think about it again. And it's one of these things that, yeah, it might not be ideal, but early days, you've got so many, say, pre-product market fit. And I generally dislike that term for other reasons, but that's another holy war we may not get into, have time to get into. But in general, right, you've got like, are we actually solving a problem? Does anyone care about? And maybe your pricing and packaging aren't optimized. And by the way, whenever I say pricing, I almost always mean pricing and packaging, but I usually just truncate that to pricing. But the problem is that, look, pricing is probably not what's going to kill you in the early days. It's because your pricing is absolutely wrong. It's because you probably built something that nobody wanted or nobody needed, right? It's very rarely that I see something but what is interesting in the early days is really understanding something like what's your price positioning? Because that's a strategic decision that we don't often really think of, but you know, it has less to do with research and just where do I want to play? If we think about a company like Southwest Airlines in the US, like they decided that they were going to be compared against, you know, not only the other airlines, but bus fare as a competitive alternative. So what is the price point at which you are inviting relative competitive comparisons, right? And so we can think about the, you know, the general auto market in, you know, again, that we've got your sort of your super low entry level players from, you know, say your Toyota Corolla, your market entry player, your Toyota Camry, then you get your premium segment. Now you've got your Lexus, your BMW, your Mercedes, maybe your Tesla Model S. Then you've got your luxury segment, right? None of that has to do with, it's not that the Toyota Corolla product manager sitting there being like, I wonder if we should price test, you know, against Lamborghini and Bugatti. It's like, that's the wrong, like you're not, there's a strategic element there that you're making a decision. But ultimately, look, when companies are sort of humming along and they're getting to a certain level of growth, look, there's all sorts of different symptoms of reasons they might come to us. But like, ultimately, like, are they meeting their goals? Is pricing getting in the way of those goals? If I think about pricing and packaging, you know, either it can be, you'll go continue using the auto industry analogy. Either it could be a lubricant in your go-to-market engine, or it could be like pouring sand in your gas tank, because it's going to affect every part of customer acquisition costs, deal length, in terms of your sales cycles, in terms of your conversion rates, in terms of obviously the actual revenue, you know, and expansion, both original new business and expansion. So, looking at those goals, is pricing ultimately getting away? Like, have you recently done a change, like a change or an increase, and has it succeeded? Why or why not? Why are we losing deals? Like, what role did price play compared to other factors? And I think one thing I didn't maybe explicitly talk about this early in my introduction, but one of the things that I pretty much play exclusively in the B2B space these days, and big difference between B2B and B2C is, in B2C, price is often a number one decision criteria of a purchase. But in B2B, it's somewhere in the third to seventh most important characteristic. You imagine, right? There's the old adage of no one ever got fired for buying IBM was a reason. It's like, well, I don't care that IBM costs more. It's like my job's on the line. And I don't want to be the guy or gal that recommends something that actually doesn't work, or you know, I have social capital at risk. I might lose my job. I don't, like, ultimately, I don't care that, you know, they cost, you know, twice the next best person. Even the other person says they can do even better things than the others, right? And so those are different things that we want to keep in mind.
Dan, you said earlier on that you truncate pricing and packaging to just pricing, and you said a lot of stuff in that answer that probably conflated the two things, pricing and packaging. Can we just be really clear before we keep going? What is packaging? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I think it's something that, you know, when I really got deep into the weeds and pricing, it's something I don't think is relatively crisply defined. And so when you start trying to learn about this space, it's another area that can be ultimately very confusing, because it's not, I think the pricing industry has a lot of work to do still to sort of standardize these terms, but I'll give you the example of the terms that I use. So this goes back to what I said before of, you know, it's not what you charge determines success, it's who and how you charge. So the what you charge we refer to as your price level. That's usually what people think of as pricing. And then what we're talking about packaging, it's this element of how we charge. And I really think of it in four different elements. And so I use the analogy of McDonald's. So let's say I go to McDonald's and I go to buy a Big Mac. Okay, so now I buy the Big Mac. The Big Mac is my price metric. I pay per Big Mac. Right. And we have this in the B2B SaaS world where I pay maybe per user or per API transaction or per amount of data stored, but that'd be my price metric. It's a perpetual transaction. I pay the McDonald's cashier a set amount of money. They give me a hamburger. There's no implication of future payments being exchanged, right, within that transaction. The transaction is complete. That's what we'd call a perpetual model. So this is our pricing model. But you might think in the subscription world, we've got subscription pricing. We have a pay-as-you-go or utility-based model, like you might have for your electricity company or other utilities. It's been very popular. You might have auction-based pricing models like you have for Facebook and Google with their ad inventory, right? So those would be price models. So that'd be the second one. So we got price metric, price model. Then if I think about my decision to upgrade this, I'm gonna get a Coke with my McDonald's meal. If I'm gonna get the small, the medium, or the large, I'm gonna pay a different price for each of those. But if you think about my price per ounce, that changes, right? And so the price per ounce of the large drink is actually much less than what I pay if I get the small drink. And we think that's an example of a price fence. So price fences will come in terms of either volume, identity, or time. And we see this all the time with other price fences. For example, if I take the bus, I may pay one price, but a student or a senior citizen, because they're, you know, they're different by their identity, they're a different person, will show some identification and pay a different price, right? So this price fence. And then we have this idea of, you know, if I'm at the McDonald's drive-thru again and I decide to get a value meal or a happy meal, this would be an example of an offer configuration or a bundle. So how are multiple disparate features or sets of components put together in a way that makes it easy for our buyers to buy a consolidated group of things, right? And so that speaks to a specific use case, right? And so there's a whole art and science that goes into properly creating those offer configurations or bundles. You might think like, oh, it makes a lot of sense if I have my burger, my French fries, and my Coke together. But if I take out the Coke and put in a coffee, I might actually drop the willingness to pay of that overall bundle, because coffee with my burger kind of actually sounds disgusting. And I'm a big coffee drinker. So there is an art and a science to how we actually construct those as well, right? And we think about all those elements together. We haven't even talked about price level, but those other elements tend to be much more important and much more difficult to change, but it can also help us reinforce our overall value story that we're trying to tell.
And Dan, when you're, you talked about all of the different options there and how you can create like various different, or you have these various different variables to create like multiple different options to try with your customers. I think particularly referring to like B2B SaaS businesses, how do you effectively do pricing research in order to understand what these variables for your business could be, like where people are going to find added value and what they'd be willing to pay for that? Like what questions can you or should you be asking?
Yeah, well, there's a lot that goes into answering that question. So, what I think makes sense is we'll kind of zoom out a little bit. Well, I think first thing that I want to dissuade folks from is, especially in a B2B context, because a lot of times people are like, oh, well, you know, obviously, if your audience is a lot of, you know, product managers, product leaders, A/B testing is very popular. I do not believe A/B testing in a B2B SaaS scenario is appropriate. We didn't touch on it, but you know, there's some elements of what defines an effective price, and some of those things are that it's transparent, it's consistent and fair. And I think A/B testing your pricing kind of violates all three of those core tenets of what good pricing is. So then the question is, well, what does a pricing research process look like? It depends what questions we're trying to answer, but overall, you could think of it in terms of a general three-step process. So first of all, we want to get general alignment of what is the objective that we're trying to achieve? What is the hypotheses that we think we are trying to get answers to? What are the straw man sort of pricing and packaging options that we think we want to go test? You'd be surprised how many companies haven't really fundamentally aligned on what they're trying to achieve, because we'll get questions like, we want to optimize our pricing and packaging. Well, optimization according to any domain only has a meaning in terms of some ultimate objective, right? You can't just generally optimize. Like, that doesn't work. If we think just about price level, there's a different price level that, you know, optimizes for revenue versus profit, right? We may be optimizing for customer lifetime value. We're trying to optimize, you know, our LTV to CAC ratio, right? There could be a bunch of different things that we could be optimizing for. And getting everyone on the same page for what we're actually trying to achieve is core, because what I found is that if you don't have that argument up front, what will happen is, on the back end, no matter how good your research is, basically the people who are hoping it goes in a different direction will just end up attacking the research, which is not what you want, right? You want to get everyone aligned in the same direction before you go out and execute. Hypothesis, goal alignment, you know, as step one. Step two, actually go conducting the research. And so, you know, I can talk at length about, you know, how we may actually go do that. And there's some, you know, I can give you some quick high level tips. And then, you know, three would just be, you know, iteration, and then a rollout plan, right? So, obviously this is a big, you know, it might just be like, oh, we'll just go ship it, right? It tends to have, there's a lot of emotional components, both on the internal side as well as the external customer side when you're rolling out this change, right? Especially in a B2B scenario, we got to make sure we have enablement for marketing, for sales, like everyone is ready to justify and speak coherently to it, right? And so we may think about doing a segmentation of our rollout plan, right? We want to, in a B2B scenario, we may have 20% of our customer accounts are 80% of our revenue, which maybe you don't run into in a B2C scenario. So maybe you want to leave those 20% of accounts until the end, once we've really streamlined our pitch and understand what the feedback has been from the rest of the market, right? Maybe we want to make sure that, you know, we give those customers ample updates of kind of where we're headed, right? So that it's not a big surprise when we finally do announce the change, right? Get our champions in those accounts to really sort of, hey, what are we missing here, right? But maybe you're much less worried about the, you know, sort of low dollar value accounts, right? So the just the implementation and rollout phase can also be very impactful there. So I'm happy to kind of dive into any one of those areas, whatever would be most interesting for you and your audience.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much in that answer, and so much to like talk about when it comes to kind of pricing research. I'm curious, like, in thinking about the sort of research that customers or like product managers, sorry, not customers, what product managers do, well, customers do it as well, is looking at comparative sort of competitors as well. Mm-hmm. You know, again, sort of more specifically in the B2B SaaS scenario, do you mm-hmm. find that some businesses are kind of hamstrung by being competitive and like constraining the way that they're thinking about their pricing by what their competitors are doing? Because actually, if you do something, if you deviate from what's the norm in your market, then that's going to cause you issues as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So one of the things that we haven't touched on yet that I think your question is pointing at is what I generally refer to as pricing orientations. Pricing orientations are, I think, very rarely discussed, or at least they're rarely discussed as a separate thing, because they're kind of the answer to the question of, how is pricing done around here? What are the things that we really take into account? What are the things that we consider when we do pricing? So in general, there's three primary pricing orientation types. So there's cost-based pricing, competition-based pricing, and customer value-based pricing, often referred to as just value-based pricing. But if we did that, then we wouldn't have our three C's, and marketers, we love our four P's and our three C's, and et cetera. So you asked specifically about competitive analysis or competitive being pinned to whatever competition is doing. And look, I mean, these are the way I look at those orientations is they're a journey. Each of them on its own doesn't necessarily give you sort of the full context, but you kind of got to know where you're at before you can move to the next level. So, you know, we were talking at the beginning about, look, if you're really early stage and you don't really understand, you know, does our product really solve a problem? Like, which problems, like, are we going to be known for solving? Like, why are customers selecting us? But you have a general idea of how, what your costs are. Like, this is where usually where a customer or company start is, because it's like, well, I know to run my infrastructure every month, it costs me this. And so I'm going to 10x that and charge that. And, you know, and it feels quantitative because you've got, you know, a spreadsheet and numbers, and, you know, the finance people really love it. But at the end of the day, it's really qualitative because your markup is a decision. There's not any, you know, finance god that says you deserve an 80% gross margin, sir. Like, congratulations. But look, ultimately, if we're trying to not make the mistake of selling $20 bills for $10, like, that's not a good business model. So we want to make sure that, look, we could at least cover our costs, right? But you don't want to stay there. So what's the next step? The next step would be something like you're pointing to, which is a competition-based pricing. Competition-based pricing is better, right? It allows us to also occupy the space that customers are occupying, right? Because at the end of the day, look, customers, I've never bought a piece of software and asked how many engineering hours, how many story points were involved in this piece of software. Like, that's never been a consideration. Like, your customers don't care, right? But your customers are comparing you against the competition. And so, you know, that helps, right? But ultimately, in your audience of good product managers will probably know this already. I learned this early in my product journey. You want to be very careful as a product manager when your competition releases a giant new major feature release and announces a bunch of features. You don't want to be like, oh man, we got to go copy all those, because you have no idea where those come from. You don't know if their product managers are doing their job. You don't know if those were all the nightmare visions of their CEO when he got off the golf course and we're like, oh man, these are all brilliant ideas and we had to build them, right? Or they got one, you know, they had to build those 10 features because JP Morgan wouldn't sign the deal at the end of last quarter unless they shipped them. Like, you have no idea what happened, right? And so I feel like pricing, we end up in the same thing, was when we have competition-based pricing, and we just get fully enamored with it, we just assume that the people on the other side have got past this idea of pricing as a black box magic voodoo, and that they've done their work and done their science and really understand their customers, and that they're playing the same playbook. Like, ultimately, the core of competitive strategy is not playing the exact playbook as the person you're next to. That gets you in a commodity market very soon. And that's a bad word in the pricing space. You do not want to be doing the exact same playbook as your nearest competitor. And so I don't know any other CEO that would outsource their demand generation strategy, that would outsource their product roadmap. Why would you do that to your pricing? It just makes no sense, right? So, but it is better, right? It gives us a little bit better review. And so ultimately then we graduate to this world of value-based pricing, where, you know, we're really trying to understand at the end of the day, like, what is the differentiated value that we create above and beyond our nearest competitive alternatives that allows us to kind of price to the value that we're really creating for our customers. But what I would say, kind of just to summarize all that up, you don't get to just skip to value-based pricing. So you have to do the steps in between. And, you know, because I'll have clients who will say that to me of, oh, hey, well, we want to do value-based pricing. And I'll be like, great. What's your, you know, break out your cost of goods, you know, for all these kind of features. What drives? They're like, oh, we don't know. It's like, okay, what's actually, we can start at the beginning. Like, it's great we have the ambition, but we can't just jump there off the bat.
Randy, what's the most effective way to learn from the best in the industry, connect with other PMs, and sharpen your skills?
Why, Lily, you must be talking about MTPCon London, happening this year on the 20th of October.
You know it, and this year's lineup of speakers is shaping up nicely. We have Tim Harford, behavioral economist, award-winning Financial Times columnist, data detective, and BBC broadcaster. That's all of those things, it's just Tim. Plus, the legend that is Mark Abraham, product director at Backbase.
There's also Randeep Sidhu, who's the former CPO at Reliance Health, and Claire Woodcock, who's the director of product for machine learning at Mozilla, and many more, including a great friend of this podcast.
That's right. And don't forget Workshop Day. On the 19th of October, there are 7 full-day in-person workshops led by experienced product managers who share their secrets and tips for success.
And finally, there's the Leadership Forum, an exclusive event for senior product leaders with carefully curated speakers, guests, and delicious food.
So grab your tickets for MTPCon London today at mindtheproduct.com/London.
So Dan, I'm curious because I've been playing around with pricing for the first time in my career on something, and I've gone through these steps to a degree, and I went out and I did some Van Westendorp to try and figure things out, and I just got this massive range of things. People just did not know. And to be fair, the competitors and comparators in this space are a huge disparity. So how do you go about defining or finding out the value of things or the perceived customer value of things?
So that's a great question. So ultimately, I think, look, we have to realize there's a longer answer to this. I'll give the shorter answer. Willingness to pay is not a universal constant like Planck's constant or the speed of light that we can just go out in the world and measure. Willingness to pay is an outcome. So then the question is, well, what is an outcome of? Like any pricing exercise is ultimately always a intersection or influenced by your costs, customer willingness to pay, customer value, and competition. And so how things like customer value, well, we could, you know, run a survey. That's one way. And Van Westendorp is, you know, perfectly legitimate. Like any of these methodologies have their drawbacks, but let's say we run at Van Westendorp, right? Let's just use that as an example. And I could run 2 surveys. Okay. And get entirely different answers. Why might that be? Well, one, if I don't understand what kind of respondents I'm looking for. So one of the elements we haven't talked about it, but one of the core elements I start with is, you know, is my services model for SaaS pricing. Services stand, the first S in there stands for understanding your customer segments. There's no average product for an average person. Similarly, there's no average price. So if I go out and ask a bunch of random strangers what I'm going to expect to pay, and then I go ask a bunch of I have another random set. I may not get the same answers back. Also, if I change the way the product is described, I may get different answers back. Now, look, the world of pricing research and market research has gone a long way, and there's answers to all of these sort of baseline objections. But you need to kind of understand that, like, ultimately, we're asking people to make a judgment call. So, for example, here I'll do it with the two of you. So, Lily and Randy, welcome to The Price is Right. What should a beer cost?
I mean, I'm in London, so it's going to be twice the price that Lily pays out in Bath.
I mean, I know more about cider because I'm from the West Country, but if you ask me about a beer, I would say for a pint of beer, I should be paying, like, I would pay maybe £4 for a premium beer and like £2 for a cheap one.
And I'm exactly right, because here in London, it's going to be closer to £6 or £8 for the beer.
Okay.
That's not what it should cost. That's what it does cost.
Okay. Excellent. Well, there are a couple of things I want to point out there. So one is, you made a distinction, Lily, on there's a cheap beer versus a premium beer, right? So maybe, you know, your version of premium is different than my version of premium, right? So if I use that word, maybe there's a different level of interpretation, right? So we got to be careful in our research design process that we understand the words that we're using, like robust, scalable, right? The marketing world is full of these words that easy to use, right? We may think, it's inherently, like, everyone knows what easy to use means. I love Tony Olwick, one of the creators of Jobs to be Done. He has a great book. I highly recommend recommend to your audience if they haven't read it. It's called What Customers Want. And he has a case study in there where they were doing a jobs to be done study. I think it was for Motorola. And they realized that when they broke it down, there were 22 different definitions that customers had in mind when you said something like easy to use for a cell phone. Like, so, you know, we have to understand are we using price terminology? People understand what that is? You guys mentioned a geographical distribution, right? Are we able to account for that when we get the results back? Randy, you said something interesting. You said it'd be somewhere between 6 and 8 pounds. You didn't say a precise number, which is interesting because we should always think about, well, that's one of the benefits of the Van Westendorp method is we always should be thinking about willing to pay as a range, even in our own internal minds. We do this all the time. Would you go out to eat? Be like, I don't know. I would go somewhere if it's kind of in the 20 to 30 buck range, but I don't know if we want to go somewhere fancy, right? It's like, but you don't know. You wouldn't say like, I'll only go out to eat if it's below $25.97, right? Like we don't think that way. Right. And so we need to understand when we do research that way. The other thing you guys didn't talk about is would that price of that beer in London, would it be different if you bought it in a grocery store versus a pub versus at a concert so what is the context that we're in, right? Because ultimately context is decisive. If you're in the, you know, if I'm trying to sell you a bottle of water, and you're just at a gas station, trying to, quench your thirst on a road trip, maybe you have one willingness to pay. But if you've been wandering in the Sahara for a week, you probably have a very different willingness to pay for that water, right? And so understanding customers' context and these, how we describe it, what's the context that they're in, is really important.
I'm not going to tell you what it cost at the music festival I went to a few weeks back. That's a totally separate category.
You guys have mentioned the Van Westendorp style of research. It would be great to just explain a little bit more about what that is and how it works.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's kind of broadly, when we think about willingness to pay, there's broadly kind of two classes of question types that we can ask. So, and those broadly be direct and indirect questioning. And there's like simulated environments, right? Like, so I can go and actually watch people shop, right? In a simulated sort of environment, et cetera. But in general, when we're thinking about like quantitative survey research, so direct would be, how much would you pay for this product? This goes back 50, 60 years now. Pricing research have realized that's a terrible question. You should never ask somebody just straight out, like, what would you pay for this? The Van Westendorp methodology it's named after a Dutch economist who developed the methodology in the 70s. And it presents a slightly better way to ask these questions. And what it relies on the idea of a ranged set of questions. So there's four questions in the survey methodology. You'll find sometimes if I'm doing a deep in-depth customer interview, I might only use three of them, but generally the questions are, at what price would this product be so cheap that you would doubt its quality? At what price would you this product be considered a bargain? At what price would you consider this product to be getting expensive, but would still buy it? And at what price would this product be prohibitively expensive? So why is that beneficial? So going back to the point we just talked about of Randy and his range for beer is like when he says 6 to 8 pounds or, you know, whatever the currency is, I don't know if he thinks that's expensive or if he thinks that's cheap or if he thinks that's right in the middle. And so that's one of the benefits I'm trying to understand is, you know, getting a sense of, you know, where is that, right? And kind of the rule of thumb is that generally most people will, be happy. They will actually pay the it's getting expensive price. But there's problems with the methodology in even those type of direct questioning methods. But they tend to work pretty well, and especially given some of the other factors I'll talk about, we may not get to in the SaaS world, they tend to be quite effective ways to get enough information around willingness to pay. The other side is, or the other category is generally what is called indirect questioning methods. And so these type of questioning methods are either we call a conjoint or discrete choice methods. And so the idea of discrete choice methods is that we're not asking people explicitly how much they would pay for something. But, you know, you may have participated in this type of research before where it's like, it shows you, hey, here's four different types of televisions. You know, one's a LG, one's a Sony, one's a, you know, whatever, you know, one's a 55 inch, a 65 inch, a, you know, 75 inch, yada, 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 right? You can think of all the different specs. One has 3D, this one doesn't, you know, and here's a bunch of different prices, and it asks you to choose which one would you choose or choose none. And so, and then you run through a repeated set of those. And the idea is that we're building a robust statistical analytical model in the background that helps correlate what how you're trading off choices, right? Choices among sets of features and price point as one of those, you know, in that, in the language, it, price is just another feature, right? It has negative utility, so it works in the opposite direction. But so those are, and there's, you know, a lot of consumer history research showing that those tend to be pretty robust in terms of their applicability to you know, empirical findings once products are launched. They do have drawbacks, and so they're not used as much in the B2B space because there's, you know, drawbacks that I probably won't bore your audience with. If anyone else is super nerdy about market research like me, feel free to reach out. I'm happy to have a longer conversation about it.
Amazing. Thanks for explaining that. This has gone so fast, and I feel like we've barely scratched the surface, but so we might have to invite you back for another part two or like round two of pricing. But let's wrap up on this one. So what metrics should we look at to measure our pricing effectiveness and how well it's performing?
Yeah, well, I think the, you know, you probably want to think through a couple of things at the high level, right? Like, so we were talking about before, like, are you meeting your goals? Is pricing getting away in those goals? Have you successfully tried, have you recently tried to do a change and it's either successful or not? You may have more tactical considerations. Do you have too many customers, you know, buying and staying in your entry level plan? Are too few customers upgrading or expanding? Do you have sales selling a bunch of customizations, right? So those would be things that you might want to be keeping an eye on to kind of keep your hone your spidey sense, your PM spidey sense that something might be going wrong there. But, you know, when I think about kind of trying to diagnose where we're at in a pricing and packaging space, might want to be looking at things like my competitive win rate. So there'd be like a number of won opportunities over the total opportunities sliced by competitor. You know, any metric is going to have, you know, in this type of category is going to have, you know, some amount of bias. You know, ultimately you may have bias from like data hygiene issues where sales reps, you know, don't accurately or consistently tag, you know, which competitors they lost to. You know, maybe prospects won't tell them, you know, very, very often the case, they won't say who else they're competing against, or maybe that they're not giving you a full list. Also, it's like, if you only have one option in your, who do we lose to, but there were five people in the deal, you don't know ultimately who the person went with, right? What does the poor sales rep do in that case, right? And you win 0% of the deals in which you're not involved. So that also creates a sample. But those are the type of things that, you know, you might want to look at. You know, percent of the deals lost to pricing. I say a good rule of thumb is that, you know, if you're priced, you know, well, losing about a third of your deals based on pricing. Again, this may also have data hygiene issues, you know, so any product manager should be well aware of that, right? Your price is too high is probably the easiest thing for a prospect who doesn't want to buy to make the salesperson go away. Like, you know, just like, I got to have something to put in my CRM. Otherwise my manager would offer me, well, tell me your price is too high, because, you know, they don't want to be like, well, actually I didn't like the way you answered my questions, Mr. Sales Guy, because all of a sudden I'm in a fight and I didn't want to be in a fight. I just want to buy a piece of software. And all of a sudden, so look, for any of these sort of win-loss codes, I would always say it's a good idea to have them. Be careful, you know, and understanding the trends is important, but having a bit of skepticism that they reflect the absolute reality is maybe healthy, right? Because a lot of times if you go do proper win-loss analysis with either, say, MarketingGo runs it on behalf of the sales team, right? Or you have a third-party agency that goes and does it, you can often find that a lot of those we lost on price wasn't actually because you lost on price, but those could be helpful. And then ultimately, you know, the list could keep going. I think the last one I'll mention is just things like discounting percentage. If you find that your discounting is sort of all over the map, right? I mean, I think it's one of these things, especially early stage companies, you know, there's definitely a difference. I didn't used to have this distinction, but I've seen it enough times now. It's definitely a distinction. There's a difference between having a discounting policy and enforcing a discounting policy. So you can come in and be like, oh yeah, no, we're not supposed to discount below, you know, 15%. And you see, you're like, well, that's not what the data says. It's like, you know, you got pretty much a Rorschach chart of, you know, there's no, you try to draw a regression line through it and, yeah, good luck. There's no sort of rhyme or reason. But, you know, ultimately, you know, we could slice that data different ways and it can give you a sense of, look, our frontline sales folks really feel like they've got no other option, right? And so we're having to really, you know, reset on price. It's not, look, the absolute, because ultimately you're only going to see discounts go in one direction, right? You're not going to see customers coming and paying you 120% of the price that they were quoted, unless they were very generous. I have yet to see that happen yet in practice. So you do want to augment that with research, right? So that's not the transactional data can be helpful for identifying if there's a problem, but it doesn't necessarily tell you what to do.
Amazing. Dan, thank you so much. I definitely feel a round two coming up.
I would love that. I'd be happy to.
And hopefully in that one, you'll tell us how much to price the podcast at. Yeah, maybe not.
I, you know, we can have that discussion. I'm happy to. I don't know if you'll love my answer.
Thanks again, Dan. This was great.
I really appreciate the time. Thank you for having me.
The Product Experience is the first
and the best
podcast from Mind the Product. Our hosts are me, Lily Smith,
and me, Randy Silver.
Lou Ron Pratt is our producer and Luke Smith is our editor.
Our theme music is from Hamburg-based band POW, that's P-A-U. Thanks to Arnie Kittler, who curates both Product Tank and MTP Engage in Hamburg, and who also plays bass in the band, for letting us use their music. You can connect with your local product community via Product Tank, regular free meetups in over 200 cities worldwide.
If there's not one near you, maybe you should think about starting one. To find out more, go to mindtheproduct.com/producttank.